Hello and welcome to a WFPL news special with Louisville Mayor Greg Fisher. I'm Gabe Bullard. Mayor, thanks for being here.
Gabe, always a pleasure.
All right, we have a number of issues to discuss, and we'll be taking your calls in the last third of the show. You can reach us at 502-814-8255. You can email news at WFPL.org or find us on Facebook or Twitter and post a comment there. We are WFPL News. Mayor, I want to start with something that has gained a lot of attention in recent months, and that's crime. Chief Conrad recently told the Metro Council that crime is up 8% in the city over last year. That's fairly significant.
It depends on what kind of crime you look at. And you know, one of the things that we're doing, obviously, with my administration is we want all the data out there. We want people to know what's going on. You know, what's gained the most attention, obviously, were the homicides that happened in the Parkland neighborhood about 2 months ago now, where we had three on one day. And that led to the formation of the Violence Reduction Task Force. When you take a look at homicides in Louisville over the last basically 7 years or so, you'll see we've ranged from the low 40s to 70 a year, and we're kind of stuck in that range. And each one of these has got a brother, a son, a friend behind him, and so it's horrible. So the question is, how do we improve? And so we're taking a look at various national models out there. It seems like urban crime is up everywhere right now. Louisville is still one of the safer large cities in the country, but we take every act of crime seriously. Other types of crime are down, like property break-ins are down. Year-to-date on homicides, I think we're around 30 or so. Last year, we would have been in the mid to high 20s at this point in time. So statistically, it's not out of control per se, but each one of them is unacceptable.
Well, we've seen a change also, it seems, in the tenor of this violence. There was just last night in Old Louisville reports of assault rifle fire going on. I think some of the neighbors had reported possibly hearing multiple assault rifles going off. Those shootings that you mentioned that spurred the creation of the Violence Prevention Task Force, one of the shootings right in front of the police. We've seen adults shooting at younger people. Is that a concern as well? It seems like regardless of the number, the actual temper is
any changing. Type of violence is a concern, right? We all want to live in a city where there's zero violence. But what we see about these are not random acts of violence. 80% of homicide victims know their assailant. So these are people that are typically dealing with criminal activity. Drugs are frequently involved. Obviously, handguns are involved. So they're not random. And as I say, the key is how do you break this cycle? And while we're one of the safer cities, we want zero acts of crime. So what the Prevention Task Force is doing is looking at multiple areas that are involved with crime, because this is not just a criminal issue. It's a community redevelopment issue. It's an education issue, health and social wellness issue. The cities that seem to be making some progress on this look at this as a public health issue as well. These are kind of learned and modeled behaviors that people are feeling like are acceptable. And obviously to the 99.9999% of the population, these are totally unacceptable. And we're putting different techniques in place. In California Parkland right now, there's a program called Project Save going on, where you see a special task force of 24 folks that are on the streets that have resulted in getting some guns off the street more than normal, some arrests as well. So we kind of know who the bad guys are in the city. And there's a very small percentage of the people, not even a percentage, a very small number of people that create the crime.
And, well, there have been reports of increased gang activity. There's more graffiti out, some of the tags that police have affiliated with gangs, some recruitment going on, perhaps a little bit more openly in some areas, according to certain reports. Do you think Louisville has a gang problem?
It's simplistic to call it a gang problem. I mean, anytime there's a crime, you have people that work with each other for distribution or protection or whatever it might be. Gangs in America right now are kind of diffusing into all types of different alliances that might be for a month, could be for a year. Typically has to do, obviously, with some type of criminal enterprise. We don't have territorial gangs per se that you see in some big cities like Chicago. So there are alliances of people that work together. The type of policing that we do here is what we call intelligence-based community policing, where we understand the networks that are out there, the relationships between these folks as well, so that you can disrupt them to eliminate any type of crime.
But you mentioned there are groups of people working together in an illegal capacity. That sounds like a gang. And Chief Conrad was on one of our broadcasts, and he used a very similar definition. But is there a reason to avoid the actual term gang? Because I think if you say people working together in an illegal pursuit,
I think people want to make a gang like some type of sensationalist word. I'm sure, what does that mean? I mean, there are people cooperating with each other for criminal enterprises. Are these large, massive groups of people that are coordinating hundreds of folks? Absolutely not. Now, when you go to bigger cities, that might be taking place. So I don't care if you call it a gang or a group or a posse or whatever. It's all unacceptable. And this is what the police force works on every day. And as I say, we talk about it because it's a fact. You know, but at the same time, we want to remember that this is not random. If you're obeying the law, if you, you know, not involved in some activity, I mean, as I said, the best way to stay out of trouble is not get in trouble. So we don't have a problem in the community that's a random type of non-targeted problem.
You're going back to your task force on violence. What do you think they really could end up doing in the long term? Are they going just to recommend things that the city should change? Are they going to take action and form some sort of new partnerships? What can this group do to actually prevent violence?
Well, the most important thing for any city, in my mind, or any organization, is to always be learning what the latest techniques are to improve anywhere, whether it's improve public safety or economic development. So I asked this group to scan the country, scan the world for best practices in violence reduction, and to understand what the root causes are behind it, how we can approach this from a public health standpoint as well, with some immediate activity to address, again, the problems mainly in our, when you geographically cluster the crime in Parkland and California neighborhoods, with some grief counseling on place immediately. Some interrupters, people that know the folks on the street and what's happening, to make sure retribution doesn't take place as well. But then we've got to take a look at the broader issue. You know, what happens with neighborhoods when they're in decline? How can we stop that? That ties into vacant and abandoned properties, which is a big issue that we have underway. How about education? I mean, there's correlations between reading levels at an early age and likelihood of incarceration later on. So how does education come into play? Out of school time, how does the foundation grant we received from the Wallace Foundation help us to keep kids busy, et cetera? Health and social wellness is another big part of it, and then our whole criminal justice system. So you can't look at this as just a single issue. It's really a whole system that we're taking a look at.
Well, you've called these shooters in various statements knuckleheads. You've called them cowards. But where do you think they come from? Is this just singular bad behavior on the part of an individual, or is there an institutional problem that has yet to be identified or solved?
It's a societal problem. When you take a look at America in particular, where you're seeing people play out activities that they're modeling either from peers or people they've looked up to, the media, where they feel like it's acceptable to go and shoot somebody. So you've got a societal issue that's taking place. And when I say societal, then all of those issues that are associated with that, as I said before, the family, the neighborhood, education, et cetera. So this obviously is a complicated issue that we're taking a look at from various fronts. And the important thing for me is that we are always trying to improve. And if there was anything that was positive that's come out of all this, Gabe, it's nobody has been trying to blame people. They're not trying to blame the police. They're not trying to blame the church. They're not trying to blame me. People are just saying, Mayor, how can I help? And really that is ultimately, as a community, is how you solve problems, when people take a look at our city as something bigger than themselves. So I'm very gratified by our citizens' response to all this.
And is part of the task force goal then to build up that community?
It very likely, in terms of where the violence has taken place,
mm-hmm.
It very likely could be. Now, we're, as I mentioned before, vacant and abandoned properties are an issue in this part of town. We have a very active task force working on that. We appropriated some money in this last budget to target some foreclosed properties that we can move on. We've gotten three state laws changed over the last two General Assembly sessions at the state level.
And what are those laws?
Before, you know, Kentucky is a property rights state, so property rights owners, as they should, have a lot of rights here. But for instance, we could not go on to the property without having some legal exposure ourselves. So that was one that was changed. Another was a financial situation where when the property finally was sold, the lien holders came before us in terms of recovering their money. Let's say the city had spent $5,000 taking care of that property over the last 3 years. We never were able to recoup those funds because there wasn't enough left in the settlement once it was sold. Now we go to the front of the line. So when the city is expending money to take care of a property, we get paid once that property is sold. So those were the two primary ones that took place. So we've gotten to a point now where we can more aggressively move onto the property, we can more aggressively maintain the property as well. And then, as I just said, with this year's budget, you'll start seeing us repurpose some of these properties, either sell them to a neighbor, turn them into an urban farm, et cetera. So we've been working hard on this for 18 years. We're making progress, not as fast as I want, but we're moving ahead.
Well, reclaiming those properties can be an issue. Is there anything else in the works possibly to start taking some of these properties that might be owned by a bank, might be just going through the process of foreclosure? Some people have talked about eminent domain. The Leo Weekly recently had a story talking about the when these liens are sold, they're often sold out to other agencies by the state, and perhaps that could be put into some sort of bond. It seems like there are still a lot of issues left before the city can really start reclaiming and fixing up some of these properties.
Well, we work on all of those areas, and that's just came out of a meeting this morning with 24 people where we're working on this whole vacant and abandoned property issue. So the issues you talked about are some of many.
Moving on to development in general and downtown development, what progress that you've seen downtown has you the most excited?
Well, of course, the epicenter kind of downtown development really was catalyzed with the completion of the KFC Yum Center and all of the activity around that. So that, I think, has exceeded everybody's expectations in terms of the activity that has been generated downtown and have really brought downtown alive. The TIF district that was associated with that, I'm waiting to see future numbers on that so that they meet the forecasts that were put together, which are helping pay for the arena bonds, which I'm sure you'll ask me about at some point in time here. The Whiskey Row development, the block just east of KFC Yum Center, obviously the first half of that block has been completed and renovated, and it's beautiful. Construction is underway in the other half of the Whiskey Row block, so I'm very optimistic about that. When you take a look at what's happened over in the Nulu East Market area, I mean, just fantastic work that's gone in place over there that shows you the power of catalytic private development. We have $14 million that's going to be spent on upgrading Market Street as well, which will be great there. Then you have, when you talk about catalytic private investment, you've got to talk about 21C, too. One of the top boutique hotels in the world. You've seen the St. Charles Exchange open up across the street from that. So Main Street is hopping. You're seeing a lot of investment in the bourbon industry as well with Michter's going to take the Fort Nelson building up to its prior previous grandeur as well. Heaven Hill along Main Street, what they're going to be doing. And then let's not forget what's happening in South 4th Street as well. We put $500,000 in this last budget for streetscape there. So that's what we're targeting, is bringing retail back downtown. So there's a lot of activity going on, and visits are up, and momentum is good.
Well, one thing you mentioned, this excitement about the businesses around the arena, Moody's, the credit rating agency, wasn't too excited. They downgraded the debt, the bonds on the arena down to junk status, and Standard & Poor's had increased its rating previously. But they cited lackluster development, one, high operating cost, but also the TIF district not really performing. Can you say that it's lived up to the hype?
Meeting the budget, it's not. And, you know, Moody's doesn't come to Louisville and look at that. They just look at a forecast versus actual. And the actual is not keeping with the forecast. And obviously that's a concern of mine, too, because the city is paying anywhere from $6.5 to $9.5 million a year on debt service on the bond. We want that TIF district to perform, so we're at the minimum, $6.5 million. The numbers that Moody's were looking at were, you know, the oldest numbers we have, which the economy's not fully recovered from there. So that's one issue. I'm thinking they will improve. The second issue is better expense management at the arena. And you've just recently seen a change from management of the arena from the Fair Board to AEG. The reason the arena authority cited for that was to have tighter expense controls there. So The revenue projections have met the forecast. U of L's done a great job relative to building their basketball programs and use of the arena. So the expenses need to be tightened up in management, and then the TIF district needs to perform better.
And as part of improving that TIF district, some of that 4th Street money would presumably end up helping that, the $500,000 you've put in for some streetscape improvements here on South 4th Street. But at what point, if the arena is the engine of economic development, at what point is it going to run on its own and not need more grants from the city here and there?
I wouldn't look at it that way. It is one of the engines of downtown, and clearly from a special event standpoint, when you're pouring 20,000 folks into downtown, whether it's for a ball game or a concert, those are, you know, episodic events. We need to get, you know, 150 to 200 events a year taking place at the Yum Center for it to really be optimized. But then you have to take a look at other needs of downtowns. For instance, when a visitor comes to downtown, a tourist, their number one question usually is, where do I shop? So we don't have a central shopping district. Nulu, there's been quite a few retail boutique shops open there, which is great. But South 4th Street's been the historic shopping center of downtown. We want a place to send tourists here. And when conventions are analyzing us versus Nashville, Indianapolis, whomever, we want to say we have a shopping district downtown as well. So it's a multi-layered effort. And when you take a look at, for instance, what's going on in the Bourbon area that I mentioned before with Michter's and Heaven Hill, et cetera, that's another angle that brings tourists to town. So it's not a one solution answer here. You've got to have a lot of diversity in your approaches.
Going back to the Whiskey Roadblock, preservationists pushed, the council pushed, your office even pushed to save these buildings. There's this group of anonymous investors, including Steve Wilson, is the name who's out there. They've put in some of their own money to save these buildings and to redevelop them. The city's put in a $1.5 million forgivable loan. There's an additional $500,000 in the city budget now. A bipartisan group of council members has questioned this. Is it the most prudent use of money to give to these developers?
What's really nice about this is the amount of private money that's being used compared to the public money. So when you take a look at investments, especially of a preservation standpoint, rarely are they able to stand on their own. So then a city has got to ask, do we want to knock these things down and start fresh? And then at that point in time, how much money is in the land and can anybody develop it? Or do you want to try to preserve the authenticity that you have as a town? So, for instance, when you take a look at Main and Market Streets, we've got more iron cast facade buildings than any city other than New York City. So you may not enjoy that, but some people, when they come to town, say, Louisville's got a really authentic sense of place. So as a city, we want to sell authenticity and originality so people have a reason to come here. If it's just any place USA, they're not going to come here. So when you focus in on the Whiskey Row project, the first loan, it's $1.5 million loan that's forgiven once there's $15 million of development into the property. In other words, they have to develop it out before that's forgiven. The investors, as they analyze the shape of the buildings more, like most of these type of projects, it's going to end up costing more and taking longer. So they needed more of an investment. They approached the city because originally when they approached, I said, you have to come up with something really creative and unique. Maybe there's a new model that's needed here. They came up with this idea of a challenge grant to the city where the investors would donate money into a revolving fund that will be there in perpetuity. And they challenged the city to put in $1 million for $1 million if they put that in. Plus, some of the original investors, to the tune of probably $2 to $3 million, are going to put their original investment in as well. So when this is all said and done, the city and Metro Council needs to approve this, as they should, because I said, look, we need to come back to Metro Council with a term sheet that they agree to that this is a good deal. When that term sheet comes to them, what they'll see is the $500,000 from the city and an amount from the private investors that ultimately should be between $2.5 to $3.5 million. So the city will get a leverage multiple of 5 to 1, 6 to 1 on its dollar. So anytime the city can invest a dollar and get $5 from the private sector in his donation, I think that's a good deal, especially when it preserves the authenticity of our heritage here.
But in preserving these buildings, you're a businessman. Isn't this part of the risk that entrepreneurs and developers should be taking on anyway and not worry about having to come back and get more taxpayer money or set up a scheme for matching funds and extra donations and all that? Isn't that just something that a group of wealthy developers could shoulder?
Well, they could shoulder it, but when they come to me with a concept where I get $5 for every dollar that they put in or that I put in, the city puts in, I'd say that's a darn good deal. Because when that happens, then there's going to be another project that needs some gap financing that it's going to go into all throughout the city as well. So they're not going to get that money back. It's a gift. It's a donation to the city.
Is this a sustainable way to develop downtown?
When you take a look, Gabe, at any downtowns, whether it's Charleston, Baltimore, whomever, when you take a look at downtown development on their own, these projects are very, very difficult to do. So a city, as has been the case here in the history of Louisville, like these other cities as well, has got to say, do we want our downtown rebuilt? It's always going to be cheaper to go to a greenfield, you know, out in the county somewhere. So the question comes back to, is a downtown important for a city? And in my estimation, it absolutely is. The heart of any city is a downtown. When people come to visit a city, they don't say, hey, let's go to the suburbs. They say, what's downtown? What's going on? So you have to have a healthy heart to a city for the whole city to be successful.
All right. And your budget also puts in some funds for development outside of downtown, especially in West Louisville. What's that going to look like?
The number one or one of the top impediments to economic development in West Louisville is large parcels of land that are aggregated together. So we're targeting some property that is half a city block, a city block, so there'll be enough space there so a developer and or a company could come and put up a building of several hundred thousand square feet and employ folks there.
All right, you're listening to a WFPL News special with Louisville Mayor Greg Fisher. We'll be back in 1 minute.
Support for WFPL comes from Clay & Cotton, where new arrivals include apparel by Pete and Greta and Johnny Was. Clay & Cotton, with locations on Bardstown Road at Cherokee Parkway, the Summit, and at clayandcotton.com. From Seven County Services, presenting Shine on Louisville Music Fest, Friday the 20th at the Kentucky Center, a musical celebration of healthy minds featuring Appalachian, Winnie and the Mojo, the River City Drum Corps, and more. Information at sevencounties.org and on Facebook at Shine On Music Fest.
You're listening to a WFPL News special with Mayor Greg Fisher. Coming up later this afternoon on Q, we'll have a conversation with Mike Stoller on writing songs that changed popular music. That's going to be at 2 this afternoon on WFPL. And on Point, we'll hear from New York Times columnist Nick Kristof about Africa Rising. That's coming up at 3 this afternoon on 89.3 WFPL.
You're listening to a WFPL News special with Louisville Mayor Greg Fisher. I'm Gabe Bullard. We're talking about development. We talked a little bit about abandoned properties or vacant properties, and that leads me into Kentucky Kingdom, which is still sitting empty out there, the former Six Flags theme park. We know the city doesn't own the land. The State Fair Board owns the land on which the park sits. But did Metro government do all, in your opinion, that it could have done to save the park or to get the park operating under new management?
Yeah, the city's role there was to assist the state. As you mentioned, the state owns the property and was in charge of all the negotiations that have gone on out there. So what the city's offered to do is provide an incentive in terms of the occupation tax. So the number of jobs that are created there will give a break on the tax payments to the owner or operator of the land so that there's less expense for them. So I didn't feel it was wise for the city to go into any kind of debt position on that. That property can generate a very profitable business on its own, and an operator should step up and do that. So we're involved to assist there and want to assist in the future. Obviously, I would like to see that as an active property.
Have you heard from any groups that are interested in reopening it?
I have not personally. Again, they would be going to the state.
Is there a point of no return with this park? We saw the Cook family, who had been looking most recently at reopening the park, said that some of the rides weren't necessarily maintained as well as they could have been. Is there a point when we'll just have to give up on the amusement park?
I hope not. It's very good for the convention and visitors business. Again, as you know, it can attract 500,000, 600,000 visitors a year, so it's part of that diverse portfolio we want as our city in terms of activities between the water park and the amusement rides. So this was a situation where there were two serious attempts at getting a deal done there, and sometimes deals don't work for various reasons, and obviously it's unfortunate that these did not happen.
The first deal, the first proposed deal with Ed Hart, why did that fall through? Looking at it, it seems as if his deal was better for the city, better for the state, involved a larger personal investment from him and his partners than the Cook family was considering. Why would that one have fallen through?
Gabe, again, the state was in charge of those negotiations, so you'd have to direct that question to them.
Do you know if it had anything to do with Mr. Hart's relationship with the governor?
No. I mean, just again, that's a question for the state.
And had you been involved in any of those talks at all?
With the first attempt at Kentucky Kingdom?
Yes.
Sure. We were approached in terms of the cities, how they could help with the park. We ended up deciding we could help with the tax incentives through occupational income. So we were aware of certain aspects of the deal, but not the whole thing.
Was your relationship with Mr. Hart a factor in any of this?
We'd have to ask Mr. Hart and the state that. I've known Ed Hart for a long time, and clearly he's a successful operator of amusement parks. But
you've been at odds recently.
How so?
Well, your Senate campaign and also the fundraising issue with the campaign that we talked about last time you're on the show.
I don't call that being at odds. He has a different point of view than I do on certain situations, which happens a lot in the job that I currently have. So I don't call that being at odds with people.
And speaking of development, I would like to go to a caller a little bit early here. This is Khalid calling. Hello?
Yes.
Yeah. Are you have a question for the mayor?
Yes. Good afternoon, Mr. Fisher.
Hello.
I was calling to pertain to the fact that no economic development was going on. I had a question that pertaining to the old Philip Morris complex. I believe that complex been out of business probably for like 15, 20 years. Now, I'm not saying that you was to blame, but I pretty much put that on the former administration that was in there like, what, for 8 years, and anything hasn't been done. I wish there would be some type of initiative going on with that. But I would like to give you an A for effort, at least, because you are trying, and maybe you can get another 4 years in terms. Maybe we can see really a big turnaround.
Well, I appreciate that, Khalid. On the east side of 18th Street there, the YMCA will be going in with a new Y there, which is great. And then U of L will also have some offices in there. That project is in the planning stages, so that's going to happen there. On the west side of 18th Street, the developers there are looking for a large tenant to come in there. There's always talk there, but that's a prime piece of real estate for the whole city that needs to be developed, and especially in West Louisville. So just know that we are very interested in getting that developed as well, and we look forward to the YMCA starting their construction.
One thing the caller mentioned was the previous administration had perhaps not done as much there. And also, speaking of the previous administration, the firefighter settlement that we've been hearing about, there may be another payment due to firefighters due to some underpayment of retirement. Do you feel that this was a problem that was left on you by the previous administration?
Well, the way I look at that, Gabe, is that anytime there's a transition from one administration to another, there's going to be some things that were left over. As it relates to the firefighters, that dispute goes back to 1985. And I think in retrospect, everybody wishes it would have been taken care of in 1985 because the amount of money that the city, we as the citizens of the city, will have ended up paying by the time this is all said and done. So we deal with them one at a time. And if it's the right thing to pay, then we pay so we can move on. If we have to if we disagree and feel like we have good reasons for disagreement, we'll appeal. But, I think my administration's reputation hopefully is one where we take care of business, we get our facts together, then we make a decision and we move on.
What's the status now with the latest decision, pay or appeal?
We're taking a hard look at that, obviously, because just, let's see, probably 4 months or so ago, we agreed with CRS to pay $10.8 million to settle a pension issue that, in our estimation, needed to be paid. This recent judgment of $6.5 million is related to that in some regard, so we're wanting to understand the relationship between those two before we make a final decision.
Moving on to another topic, you've spoken a few times, you've been fairly outspoken on this. You were also on the Charlie Rose program discussing this, about the need for more power to cities, to give mayors a little bit more power. Do you feel that your own power is limited compared to what the state government has, what the city or the federal government has?
Well, it's compared to the state and cities we compete with, it absolutely is. And I'm not interested in power to be powerful. I'm interested in the office having enough leeway and power so that we can be competitive. Kentucky is a state where we're the fourth most centralized state in terms of cities sending their tax dollars to the capital and then those tax dollars being redistributed. It's well known that Louisville gets about 60% of the tax dollars back that we generate here. We could do all kinds of things if we got 100% back, roads, bridges, social services, et cetera. Now, I realize in a state like Kentucky, we're going to be helping fund some of the rest of the state. We're the economic engine, and we always are going to be, just like Kentucky receives money from the federal government for the same reason. So, but what we need for all of our cities in Kentucky, in my estimation, is to have more tools in the toolbox for economic development. And what you're referring to is these. What I was referring to on the Charlie Rose show was the need to have more flexibility with local options, where cities, where citizens vote on whether or not they want certain investments to be made in a city. So, for instance, let's say that we want a new forensics crime lab here so we can more quickly process DNA samples to get bad people off the street, and that's going to cost $25 million. Right now, we can either bond that through general funds, or the cities that have local options, the citizens vote and say, hey, we'll pay for that through an extra half a cent tax over 10 years. And the, so the citizens decide what they want to be. So there are 36 states right now that allow their cities to have local options. We don't in Kentucky. So let's say when I go to Denver and I see a new forensic crime lab that they spent $34 million on, a new arts center, new schools, we are at a disadvantage that our people can't even have a say on that.
Well, is this that would require a change to state law? We talked about the Kentucky Kingdom situation with the state acting for something that is largely a city interest, and here we're talking about the state not acting to do something that would be in the city's interest. Is there a disconnect there, and what are you doing to overcome that, to give the city a little bit more power in the state so you could get this passed?
On the local option.
Yeah.
Yeah, because the state owns Kentucky Kingdom.
Right.
So that's a whole different deal. No, we need – so this requires a change in the state constitution. So in order to enact that, we need three-fifths of the General Assembly to vote for a change in the state constitution. And then the citizens, all 120 counties, would have to vote on that. So that's something that you will see many of the mayors in the state working on, just so we can have an option. I want to emphasize this is the option of the people on how we want to grow. We're one of our goals for the city here that we're getting ready to kick off is to create a 25-50-year vision for what the city is going to be looking like in terms of roads, bridges, public arts, facilities, whatever it might be. Because when you travel to cities that have that type of foresight and planning, it results in some tremendous beauty that's appealing for people to live there and businesses to locate there. We need a current plan for that as well. And when we develop that, then I think our citizens should have the opportunity to say, we like parts of that plan. Let's invest in ourselves. And right now we don't have that option.
Well, 5 years ago, voters overwhelmingly rejected the library tax that would have helped fund the libraries. What makes you think they would support the local options that would come before them if this change happened?
Well, I'm a glass half full guy, Gabe, you know, where I see positive things, not always negative things. But that is a great example of the citizens having a choice. And so they voted with that, and you need to respect that choice. There could be other things that citizens want. You know, they might go to Chicago and say, my gosh, look what they've done with Millennium Park. We should be competing with Chicago. What's our own version of that? So the question in a lot of these things is, what do we want to be as a city? Do we want to be negative naysayers, or do we want to be positive builders? I want to have a city where people are excited about living here like they are today, where they see positive aspects to our city, and they want to grow. We've got to grow so we can create opportunities for people to realize their potential. better education, better jobs. We have to have a city where a company wants to relocate here, even more so than what they need to do today. So to do that, you have to invest, because we're competing with cities that are investing. And sooner or later, if we don't invest in ourselves and in our amenities, we won't grow as fastly as we have, as fast as we have been.
Well, if the option is to be negative, as you say, or to build, then it was the voters who would have taken the negative aspect there 5 years ago in rejecting the library tax. How do you convince them that it's worthwhile to have this local option to pay for, say, a bus service or a forensics lab or a large piece of public art?
I think that people will say, if I get to choose my destiny, that's a good thing. Right now, they don't have a voice. A citizen should have a voice. And even if the voice is to say, no, I'm fine with that. But right now, we don't have that option at all. So the mayor of Lexington feels the same way. Various other mayors and county judges around the state do as well. So we just want a tool in the toolbox that is available in 36 other states, even if we never use it. But when you go to compete, if you don't have the same weapons that your competitors have, you're already halfway behind.
During your campaign for mayor, there was some confusion over whether you supported what some people were calling the arts tax and what exactly that would be, how this tax would be levied to go to arts. You said you did support the library tax, but not higher taxes in general. And you also said there wasn't an appetite for discussion around higher taxes at that time. What has changed?
Again, this is an option, okay, as opposed to us just saying let's raise the taxes and the citizens don't have a voice in it. Two very different things. What I, again, see, for us to be competitive, we need this option. And it would be up to me and other leaders in the city to say, here's what a local option is all about. You get a chance to choose what you want as a city, just like if you own a home, you get a choice to what kind of shingles you want to buy for your roof. Nobody tells you that. You get a choice, and that's all we're asking for here. And again, if you want to be a modern, progressive city, you want to have as many tools as you can to compete with other cities. And ultimately, that's what this is about.
Well, I can see you wanting that, but going back to this, if the library tax is rejected, it seems like you would just have to be pretty constantly campaigning for a local option. If you're saying there's not an appetite for higher taxes or a discussion around higher taxes, how do you change that appetite?
Let's take an example of Oklahoma City, who has a local option in their city. They started off with an arena, and the citizens said, let's build this arena. That was after the terrible explosion, that terrorist attack they had down there. They said, we want to remake ourselves. We see a bright future. Let's start with an arena. Well, that arena then led to them getting an NBA team when Katrina hit New Orleans for a couple of years. Then, of course, the team went back to New Orleans. One came available, located in Oklahoma City, NBA finalists. Who would have ever thought that Oklahoma City would have an NBA team that's a finalist? And when I talked to the mayor in Oklahoma City, single best thing he says ever happened to him. Brings the whole state together to celebrate that. That's what a local option did. Then they said, you know what? We need better schools. Citizens vote on that. Well, they voted on it. Guess what? Better schools. Then they said, let's create this waterfront, which is basically a big creek down there. Let's dam it up and make an Olympic rowing facility here because we're more emphasis on health and tourism. Well, they did it. That's now where the Olympic rowing team trains. So this was a city that has a positive view of their future and voted on these one at a time. And when you vote on them, it's for X percent increase on a sales tax that's going to be over in 10 years. They don't go on in perpetuity. So it's just a question of having a dialogue about what you want your city to be. Some you'll win, some you won't. But the important thing is to have the dialogue.
All right. Plenty more to talk about with Mayor Greg Fisher, and we'll do that in just a moment on a WFPL News special. We'll also take your calls, 502-814-8255. You can email news at WFPL.org or find us on Facebook or Twitter. We're WFPL News.
Support for WFPL comes from Proof on Main, bringing farm-fresh ingredients from Woodland Farm and other local producers to the table weekly. This week's menu includes peanut fingerlings, contender beans, eight-ball zucchini, and prairie blush new potatoes, serving breakfast, lunch, and dinner. Details at proofonmain.com. Our business supporters find our high-integrity, clutter-free environment to be a powerful, cost-effective way to stay favorably top of mind with their customers. Sponsorship opportunities include WFPK's Waterfront Wednesday. To learn more, click on Business Sponsorship at louisvillepublicmedia.org. Thanks.
You're listening to a WFPL News special with Mayor Greg Fisher on 89.3 WFPL, Louisville's NPR news station. And coming up later in the afternoon on Point, we'll hear from New York Times columnist Nick Kristof. He's just back from Africa. He says it's coming up fast and American businesses need to get in the game. That's coming up this afternoon at 3 on WFPL.
You're listening to a WFPL news special with Louisville Mayor Greg Fisher. I'm Gabe Bullard here talking with the mayor, and now we are going to the phones. Let's talk to Nidia in Schnitzelburg. Hello, are you there?
Yes, I am.
All right, what's your question for the mayor?
I'm actually a new resident of Louisville. I moved from Chicago 2.5 years ago into Schnitzelburg neighborhood, and this question is in reference to the citizens having a voice in reference to the development of the city. I did speak to the mayor a couple months ago about my noise issue, the fact that I have to deal with 85 decibels of noise coming from UPS throughout the overnight hours. He told me to get my neighbors involved, and I've spoken to several residents of Schnitzelburg, and everyone's pretty tired of not being able to sleep. It's very frustrating, and I'm wondering when the city is going to step up and, you know, do what's right by the citizens of Schnitzelburg.
All right. Thank you for your call, Mayor.
Okay, thanks, Nidia. So the Regional Airport Authority, and if you haven't connected with them, please do so. You know, this is the program that they have for noise abatement in homes that are over the flight path of the planes that are coming in late at night. So there's a specific program that's in place for them to, you know, noise-proof to the best way possible they can homes like yours. So if you don't know how to do that, feel free to call my office. It's 574-2003, and we will connect you up with the Regional Airport Authority and that plan that they have. They've soundproofed thousands of homes since those new flight patterns have come into place.
All right, let's go now to Alec on the line. Hello, Alec.
Hello. I'm a student here from Louisville, and I really appreciate all that you've done, Mayor, since you've taken office. But I was curious about TARC and about improving public transportation. It seems over the past few years, I used to ride TARC quite frequently and not so much anymore, but I've seen a lot over the years that TARC has been cutting services and cutting lines. Is there any way to possibly reverse that and improve the routes, increase routes, and to possibly lower the fares again?
Public transportation is an area that's frustrating for lots of folks. The issue is that public transportation is heavily subsidized by the federal government, about the tune of 60% or so. The fare box covers, it's in the 20% range of the total cost of TARC. So this is a situation where, unfortunately, because of limited budgets, you've got to make a decision. Louisville and Jefferson County is 385 square miles. We have a population of about 750,000 people. So we're not a dense city when compared, let's say, to Chicago or New York, where you see tremendous public transportation options. So we either have to try to, you know, stretch TARC out, and we go outside of Jefferson County, as you know, or condense it and limit options that then have more frequency. So one of the things that's being tested right now and has been over the last year are the every 15-minute bus routes that you see now on the Bardstown Road Broadway corridor and then also on the Dixie Highway Preston corridor. And we're going for a third one right now that would run basically from the airport down 4th Street to downtown. So that you, if you want to take the bus, you'll know if you don't catch the one you wanted to, that every 15 minutes a bus is going to operate. So it'll give you that type of consistency. On the two routes that we've tested this so far, we've seen ridership up 18% and 22%. So we're somewhat optimistic. So we're kind of running these pilots to see if we can make some more sense out of increasing public transportation on certain routes.
Should there be a change to the funding mechanism for TARC, since it comes largely from the occupational tax, and when people lose their jobs, they may be more need public transit more, but that's when public transit funding drops? It seems that it's tied to need in a reverse way. Should there be some sort of change to how TARC is funded?
Well, the big issue is just how do we pay for public transportation for the entire country, especially in low-use areas like we do. We should get more help from the state when it comes to public transportation. The state of Indiana actually gives us as much money as the state of Kentucky gives us because of the routes that we run over into Indiana. So when it comes to the percentage that we get from the state compared to other cities, that's less than what it should be as well.
All right, a similar call on the line now from Michael. Hello, Michael.
Hello. I have a question kind of similar to public transportation, but also about the desire to live in a downtown environment. But Louisville has so many vehicles on the streets that it makes things like walking across the street so dangerous. What could we possibly do to improve that? An example is even the Highlands and Bardstown Road, which is one of the most walkable streets in the city. But yet, when you look at it, there's more cars than there are people sometimes.
Mayor?
Well, obviously, pedestrian safety is something that everybody should practice in terms of crossing at lights. You know, all of America is, except in the big cities, pretty dependent on automobiles. You're seeing the CAFE standards for average miles per gallon go up, which is a good thing for the environment. As much as we can do to emphasize and support cycling in the city, we're trying to do that as well. That's an important part of a city, as well as pedestrian safety. So I would just say we're working on it as much as we can. I guess one other thing, if you want to take a look at this, kind of a tangent, is when you're seeing one-way streets go to two-way streets, that slows traffic down as well, which we think is good for pedestrian safety.
All right. Thank you very much for your call, Michael. And moving on to another issue, looking at city politics, we've seen Councilwoman Barbara Shanklin embroiled in an ethics controversy here around some spending for a job training program. Are you concerned that this is a repeat of the Judy Greene scandal?
Well, anytime there's a question about how city funds are spent, you know, I get very concerned because people want to say there's transparency, it follows certain rules, et cetera. The Metro Council proceeded with, I think, due haste last year. They were well advised in terms of the committee that they put together. Our Ethics Commission, which really represents the city on this, conducted the hearing, and there needs to be an official complaint filed to them for anything to take place here. And then the Metro Council has their own government accountability and ethics standpoint as well. So there's multiple layers of jurisprudence out there to make sure the right thing is done here. But obviously I'm concerned when people have questions about how city money is spent. When we came into office 18 months ago, in order to address that, I asked our head of our Office of Management and Budget to enter into a quarterly process of reconciliation of funds that were, or grants that were expended, with the receipts that came back. So those monies are only released on a quarterly basis based on the fact that the money was actually spent. So that was the way that we addressed a more responsible way to spend the money.
Your administration has taken a slightly harder line on this than it did during Councilwoman Green's controversy. Your spokesman, Chris Pointer, recently told the Courier-Journal, "Anytime city tax dollars are not spent as they're intended to be, it's a concern to us and the mayor, and that appears to be the case with this situation." Why the harder line here?
I wouldn't say it's a harder line. It's just if there's a concern, it needs to be addressed, and it needs to be addressed for Councilwoman Shanklin as well. The important thing is everybody needs to get all the facts out, and then once the facts are out, a decision will be made. And I know that she wants to get her opinion told and heard as well. That's important. So while all this stuff is being in the he did, she did type of category, we got to remember there's reasons why we have hearings and trials and all this in our country. It's so people can get a fair shake. And that's the main thing that I'm interested in seeing take place.
This, again, brings up the question of discretionary funds in the Metro Council. Do you think there's more misspending going on there?
Well, the way we approached that, again, was the quarterly reconciliation of grants. And are there receipts for the money being spent? And I've asked, and Steve Rowland, who heads our Office for Managing Budget, I've asked him for the latest summary of that, which he was in the process of compiling anyway, so that we can determine if there's other reasons to be concerned here. But clearly the public is thinking about this, and we want to be helpful in that regard.
And in your last budget address last year, you warned that there may be cuts to some of that spending. And with these recent stories, do you think that money needs to be cut?
Well, I think you're talking about two different issues there, right? External agency funding and discretionary funding?
No, discretionary funding among council members.
Well, that's a big discussion that we had throughout this whole process. Of course, the Metro Council expresses strong opinions about keeping their funds. I think if this process with the councilwoman goes forth, people will continue to ask those questions. I think it's beyond fair for the citizens to expect that here's what the monies are, here's how they're spent, here's how they're accounted for, here's a public good to the use of that. And if we can't verify that, then we should take a different look at it.
And perhaps note also that you would cut your own office's discretionary fund.
Thank you for bringing that up. Yes, I cut my discretionary fund to zero.
One more issue I want to get into. Sources have told WFPL News that Public Works Director Ted Pullen was asked by your administration to resign. Can you confirm that?
Who are your sources?
Can't reveal it.
Yeah, isn't that convenient? No, Public Works obviously is a big department for us. It's a $90 million department, so it's our second biggest after our police department.
Well, I will say we filed a records request for a complaint against Pullen, and we were told that there's an investigation going on, and we couldn't get those records. What's this investigation?
Well, we have personnel issues all the time, and obviously we don't discuss those. Public Works does a lot of good work all day throughout the entire city, and we'll keep our head down there and try to be the best in the world at what we do.
All right. Well, moving on, going back to this council spending, actually, and this thought of cutting the funding, are you hoping that you would be the example by cutting your own office's discretionary fund, that perhaps the council might look into accepting a cut to theirs?
Well, obviously the reason why I did that in this last budget was to say, again, I can't, if I can't be a model like with this, as we did with some sustainability recycling efforts earlier today, then I certainly can't ask other people to take a hard look at what they're doing. And I would assume they're doing that as well, and that'll be part of our next budget discussions.
All right, that's all the time we have. Mayor, thank you very much for being here.
Okay, Gabe, thanks for your time.
All right, this WFPL News special was produced by the WFPL News staff. Our production team is led by Brad Yost and Laura Ellis. For more information, visit WFPL.org. I'm Gabe Bullard.